The WTNS Communication Lines gives you 2 hours of local news, weather, sports, and information. WTNS Radio gives you everything you need to know. We are live, and we are local. And it all starts with WTNS News.
Kiss it goodbye. I'm Jeremy Scott. The Coshocton House, where the 2021 murder of Brianna Ratliff took place, will soon completely be gone. The county land bank had wanted to clean up the property at 1802 Chestnut Street prior to raising it. However, some logistical concerns had come to light about that cleanup. Thus, city property code investigator Jeff Corder made a motion to proceed with just simply demoing the property entirely.
Well, I say tell Vic to start and get the dumpsters up there and haul things away.
Once the property is indeed demoed and remediated by Vic Allen Construction, which was awarded the project a couple of months ago, sealed bids will be taken for the purchase of the lot, which is valued at $23,300. A West Lafayette man appears to be okay after a wreck in Conesville yesterday that took place about a quarter after 3 on State Route 16 near Franklin Township Road 480. 29-year-old John Lindig II was eastbound on 16 when he lost control of his truck, went off the roadway, struck a fence, a gas line, and a utility pole, and caused several power lines to fall onto State Route 16 and even a home. The power lines on the home did indeed cause that residence to catch fire. Conesville Fire Department, though, was on scene and was able to quickly put it out. Lindig sustained only minor injuries and did not want treatment at the scene. That's the only accident from yesterday's Coshocton County Sheriff's Office report. Complaints: a resident of Florida reported vehicle damage that occurred in the 23,000 block of State Route 83 North. A tall grass and weeds notice was served in the 600 block of Locust Street. 10 minutes later, another tall grass and weed notice was issued in the 600 block of Locust Street. A resident in the 1500 block of Elm Street reported a fraud. A tall grass and weeds notice was issued in the 600 block of South Lawn Avenue. A junk notice was served in the 600 block of South Lawn Avenue. A tall grass and weeds notice was issued in the 900 block of Kenilworth Avenue, and Jodell Powell of Coshocton reported damage to her vehicle. West Lafayette Mayor Steve Bordenkircher says progress is being made concerning reconstruction of the 132-year-old Kirk Street drain in Lafayette Township. The Kirk drain was compromised during the June 2019 flood, which ruined many people's homes in and around the village.
I would say it's safe to say that there is a solution being talked about fixing that. But it's contingent on financing.
The Kirk drain repairs would affect approximately 6 property owners in the village, and letters detailing the proposed work were to already have been sent to those residents. The drain was installed in 1890 and made of 18-inch clay tile. It couldn't hold 7.5 inches of rain that fell in 2.5 hours. A former teacher, district superintendent, and higher education leader has been named Ohio's new state superintendent. Stephen Dakin is a former vice president of the Ohio State Board of Education, which voted 14-4 with one abstention yesterday to approve his hiring. Dakin succeeds former superintendent Paolo DeMaria, who retired in September. So Stephanie Siddons had been serving in an interim role overseeing Ohio's public K-12 education system since then. The Fordham Institute, a pro-charter school advocacy organization, says Dakin's varied background makes him, quote, ideally qualified for the position. Besides classroom and administrative experience, Dakin recently oversaw Columbus State Community College's school and community partnerships. Well, just like about everything else, gas prices are continuing to rise. The average price for a gallon of gasoline nationwide this morning is around $4.40. Industry experts such as Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for Gas Buddies, say this is a global issue, not just one the U.S. is facing.
Global demand has been going up for crude oil. And now at the same time, we're taking Russia's oil out of the global market, and there's nothing to replace it. And that's why the price of oil's been going up.
Here in Ohio, prices have jumped around 20 cents in a week, and we're looking at an average price at around $4.13. Even overnight, we've been seeing some areas jump up double digits. Speaking of price hikes, don't be surprised if electric bills start climbing this summer, not just because of the AC. Natural gas prices could cause standard electric generation rates to go up as soon as next month. Ohio allows consumers to shop for their own energy suppliers, but if you don't, you're charged the default rate based on utility auctions. American Electric Power in Columbus says its increase will be about 2 cents per kilowatt hour, which means people using 1,000 kilowatt hours each month would spend 18 more on their electricity. And a goal that's been a year in the making has officially been reached by the Coshocton County Sheriff's Office. The office has been recognized for meeting all the standards of the Ohio Collaborative, a panel of law enforcement experts and leaders throughout the state, which in 2015 set forth a series of 10 standards for police departments and sheriff's offices to meet. They are use of force, recruitment and hiring, community engagement, body-worn cameras, telecommunicator training, bias-free policing, employee misconduct, vehicle pursuits, wellness, and mass gatherings. Sheriff Jim Crawford tasked Lieutenant Chip Eudicious with editing 186 policies to accommodate the collaborative, then sending those edited policies to Crawford, who would sign off on those policies. Crawford recognized Eudicious for all of his efforts.
And trying to lasso these gentlemen down once a week is a challenge in itself, let alone getting the policies all updated.
Crawford says the agencies first started working towards 100% compliance in March of 2021. I'm Jeremy Scott, WTNS News.
It is 5 minutes after 9 o'clock, 56 degrees currently in Coshocton. Good morning, everyone. How are you? It is time for the Communication Lines program, and I am your host, Mike Bechtel, here with you till 11 o'clock this morning. And we have guests all morning long, and we might have a sliver of open phone lines towards the end of our show today, but I doubt it because we have a lot of interesting things to talk about and to learn about this morning. And the weather has just been absolutely gorgeous here the last couple of days. School is just about out. Graduation is ahead of us, and many people might be turning their thoughts to summer vacation and summer travel, and a lot of things to do that are not very far here from the state of Ohio, Coshocton, Ohio. Louisville, Kentucky, a hot spot last weekend with the Kentucky Derby. And Louisville, a great city to stop and explore, maybe often overlooked as you drive through it on your way to Nashville or Florida, but certainly worth a pit stop a day or two or make a vacation out of it. You have got the Kentucky Derby and the Churchill Downs, as mentioned, and the Bourbon Trail begins in Louisville, Kentucky. It's the home, the birthplace of Muhammad Ali, and they have a fantastic food scene as well. And one of the highlights of your trip to Louisville will be the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory. Baseball bats, the premier name in baseball bat, Louisville Slugger, had its origins, obviously, in Louisville. And we're going to spend some time this morning with Nick Fuchs from the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Nick. Thank you for being with us today.
Of course. Thanks, Mike, for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, Nick, I'd like to start off with this. We have a gentleman that originally from Kentucky, lives here in Coshocton, and he has corrected me on more than one occasion about the pronunciation of your city. I say Louisville. He tells me I'm wrong. How do you say it?
Yeah, it's just Louisville. You just got to let it really roll off the tongue and kind of flow. You don't need to move your mouth a whole lot. It's not Louisville or Louisville. You just kind of let it flow, and it's Louisville.
Louisville, okay. So you take that long word and try to just make one syllable out of it. Okay.
And essentially, yeah.
Nick, can you give us the origin story of Louisville Slugger baseball bats? How did the company get started?
Yeah, so a lot of people have heard of Louisville Slugger, obviously, but not as many people have heard about Hillerick and Bradsby Company. So Hillerick and Bradsby Company are the makers of Louisville Slugger bats. They made the very first Louisville Slugger bat all the way back in 1884. The Hillerick family were German immigrants that came over to the United States in the mid-1800s. J.F. Hillerick started a wood shop in 1859. He's our founder of the company. And so, you know, before we made baseball bats, they were making generic wood products that you would see in that time, you know, butter churns, bedposts, porch rails, stuff like that. But one day in 1884, J.F.'s son, Bud, who was working at the wood shop, he started 4 years prior as an apprentice when he was just 14 years old. So in 1884, Bud was a big baseball fan. So Bud decided to skip work one day. We had a pro team in Louisville at the time called the Louisville Eclipse. So So Bud walked down to the stadium, wanted to watch a baseball game one day. Well, during that game, the Eclipse star player Pete Browning broke his bat. And, you know, it's 1884, so we're not, you know, it's a different time. You can't just kind of walk down the street to a local sporting goods store and buy a bat. There were no dedicated bat manufacturers at that time. So Bud, after the game, walks down to the field, says, "Hey, Pete, you know, I work for my dad's wood shop. We're just right up the street. Would you like to come back with me? And I bet you I can turn your bat out real quick, and you can be able to use that bat in tomorrow's game." So Pete takes him up on the offer. They go back to the wood shop, sit down for a couple hours. Bud starts turning out the bat on his lathe, and they are taking measurements, and they finally get it to where it feels just right for Pete. So next day, Pete uses that bat in the game, goes 3 for 3, and the rest is really just history. You know, everybody from that point on starts asking him, you know, "Hey, Pete, where'd you get that bat? I want one just like it." And Pete would say, "Oh yeah, go talk to the Hillericks down the street. They'll take care of you."
Well, what, 3 for 3, and baseball players do have a tendency to be a little superstitious. So he said, "I got a good thing going."
Absolutely.
and kept going. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely, no, you're fine. From that point on, you know, everybody, he starts pointing everybody towards the Hillericks. Soon after that, we transition our company full on into baseball bats. Pete Browning's nickname actually was the Louisville Slugger, being that he played for Louisville's hometown team and was a power hitter at that time. So we kind of adopted that as our own, and we trademarked that in 1894, and the company just grew from there.
Where did the bats typically come from before Louisville Slugger came around?
Well, it was a lot of companies similar to ours, wood shops that didn't make baseball bats per se, but had the capabilities, had the equipment needed to make baseball bats. So players would, when they were traveling, they would just kind of try to find a local wood shop and have them turn out a bat or two for them while they were in town. Now, like I said, there were no dedicated bat manufacturers at that time, so none of these other wood shops really had the idea or the thought, I guess, to jump into the baseball bat business full on like we did. So we were the first company that really was just dedicated to making baseball bats.
How did the Louisville Slugger and those baseball bats become so dominant in Major League Baseball following that day in 1884? There came a time where the Louisville Slugger was used almost exclusively by Major League Baseball. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think a lot of it just has to do with the fact that, like I said, we were the only dedicated company. We were really on the forefront of marketing and actually signing players to contracts. We were actually the first sporting goods manufacturer, sporting goods company, to sign a player to a promotional contract. And that was Honus Wagner, who we signed in 1905. So from there, you know, legends of the game, Babe Ruth used our bats, Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, a lot of those guys that are really synonymous with just baseball history, used our bats. And, you know, we really had elite customer service at that time. We would let players come into our factory and choose the wood that they wanted for their bats. You know, they would, if there was anything wrong, we would always take care of it. Ted Williams was a guy that was famous for being very particular with his bats. And so, there are stories where he would be able to tell if his bat was an eighth of an inch off in the diameter of the handle. And so we would always take care of that and, you know, fix it up for him and give him more control over, you know, the type of wood that we're using and the process that we do. So really, I think it was our customer service and then just kind of our early efforts in marketing the product.
And the fantastic marketing to players that were idolized by kids and adults at the time, and the Louisville Slugger. And again, at one point was almost or maybe exclusively, it's not anymore, still widely used in Major League Baseball, but that was just about the only bat that was used. Now, what makes a great baseball bat? What type of wood is used? Where does it come from? What makes it ideal, et cetera?
Yeah, so we get all of our wood from our forest. We have forests in Pennsylvania and New York, over 5,000 acres. And those forests are north facing. So basically what that means, without getting into all of the science mumbo jumbo, which honestly I probably couldn't tell you, the north facing slopes in those forests are the coldest, which make for, number one, a shorter growing season, and produces harder wood. So we use, it used to be ash was our primarily used wood. Nowadays, we still make ash. Only about 5%, though, of our bats are ash. Nowadays, we use maple and birch. And maple was really popularized back in the 1990s with all of those heavy home run hitters were using maple because it was a harder wood. And so maple is a harder wood. Ash is more flexible. Birch is really a mix of the two. So that's kind of where we've seen a lot of players start gravitating towards, is that mix between the hard and the flexible wood. And then, you know, like I said, maple is the hardest wood, which has become very popular for a lot of players.
Will the players tell you that the differences in the wood, the different type of wood, is related to the performance of the bat and what they can do with it?
Sure, yeah. Players have, you know, tried multiple different types of wood, and through all their testing and batting practice and all that, they are able to identify, you know, I feel like I hit better with this type of wood, or I feel like this bat over here suited me better. And then from there, they tell us, you know, what measurements, what wood they want, what model they want, and we make it for them.
Does Louisville Slugger still, that back in the beginnings, did they use those ash trees from New York and Pennsylvania, or was it more local wood back in the 1800s?
So I think it was a little bit more locally, plus kind of working with some other wood companies. We didn't really open those forests until the 50s or 60s, I believe, the 1950s or 60s. But, you know, ever since we've opened those forests, we've always followed sustainable growth. And one of the coolest facts that I think that we share on our factory tour is the fact that we cut down about 40,000 trees per season to make all the bats that we need, but we actually grow more trees than we cut down. So we're constantly planting and you know, preserving those forests and just really making sure that it's sustainable and that it's something that we can do for the long run.
Sustainable company, sustainable industry. Now, the emerald ash borer, the insect, wiped out all the trees, virtually all the ash trees in Ohio a few years back. Did that have an impact on Louisville Slugger? You mentioned only about 5% are ash these days. Did the bug have anything to do with that, or was the company, the industry, already gravitating towards other types of wood?
Well, it definitely did play a role, and there's actually a part of our museum, a small exhibit, where we do talk about that. But as I mentioned, you know, the home run hitters of the 1990s, you know, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, those guys that were really generating a lot of excitement, they were using maple bats. And a lot of players started seeing, oh, wow, so maybe you do get more power with maple with the harder wood. So a lot of players just started making that switch naturally, and then it kind of just so happened where our ability to make ash bats wasn't what it used to be, but not a lot of players were ordering them, you know, at that time anyway. They were all kind of naturally making the switch already.
Our guest is Nick Fuchs from the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory in Louisville, Kentucky, and we'll take a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit about the museum and the giant baseball bat and what all you can see and do. We'll be back with Nick once again right after these words.
Spring into summer at J&R Door with some great specials during the month of May. This month only, receive a 25% discount on installation of all products sold at J&R Door. Or receive a free Genie 1028 opener with the purchase of a Wayne Dalton 8300 residential garage door. Or qualified buyers can get up to 18 months interest-free financing. Take advantage of one of these great specials during the month of May only. Every purchase will enter you into a drawing for free giveaways. That's J&R Door on 36, or give them a call at 623-2782.
For winning Ohio lottery numbers 24 hours a day, call the B-Dry Lottery line at 622-CALL. That's 622-2255. Let B-Dry transform your damp basement into useful living space.
Who do you choose for your home health care? a company with over 50 years of experience, or someone still learning? Hi, I'm Tim Postlewaite with College Park Home Care. And for over 50 years, we've provided care for the elderly, the disabled, and chronically ill. Our services include wound care, medication monitoring, pain management, doctor-ordered regimens, and physical therapy. But best of all, College Park Home Care comes to where you're most comfortable, your home. To learn more about what sets us apart from the others, call College Park Home Care at 740-623-4607.
Get the local weather forecast by calling the Jeff Drennan Ford Weather Service 24 hours a day at 622-0194. Our Memorial Day sale is going on the whole month of May with $2,500 minimum for your trade-in only at Jeff Drennan Ford, South 2nd Street in Coshocton.
Are you confused about the differences between independent living, assisted living, residential care, and nursing homes? The Dr. Donald E. Potts Foundation can help you determine the proper level of care for your loved one. Contact Derek Potts at 740-294-3072 to arrange a complimentary consultation.
Sunshine today, warm with highs in the lower 80s for tonight, clear. Lows in the lower 50s, and for tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Currently, it is 56 degrees in Coshocton, and we are back once again with Nick Fuchs from the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory in Louisville, Kentucky. And Louisville, not as far away as you might think it is, about 280 miles from downtown Coshocton, about a 4.5-5 hour drive away, depending on where you are located, and many things to see and do in Louisville. The Louisville Slugger Museum is located in downtown Louisville, not far from the river, and certainly around other attractions as well. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory and what your guests see and do when they visit?
Yeah, so we opened back in 1996, the museum part of it, and so we just celebrated our 25th anniversary last July. The first thing that people will see before they even reach our location is obviously our big baseball bat. The big bat is what we call it. It's 120 feet tall, 68,000 pounds, and it's a replica of the Babe Ruth R43 model bat we made for him and that he created when he was playing.
Is it, in fact, the world's largest baseball bat?
It is, in fact.
Okay.
Yes.
And 120 feet tall. I've seen photos, but I didn't realize it was that tall. Is it made of wood?
It is not made of wood. It's made of steel. And we put it out front of our doors in 1995 prior to the museum opening. I mean, you should have seen, you know, the truck that thing came in on. It was massive, and, you know, they had to shut down Main Street for parts of the day, and it was really something to see.
The truck, obviously, at least 120-plus feet long. Okay, so a lot of opportunities for selfies there. People, before they even go in the museum, taking lots of photos of that bat in the museum. What are you going to see inside, Nick?
So once you come inside our front doors, we've got our signature wall, which houses every player that has ever signed a contract with us. The signature that they sign on their contract, we turned into wood plaques, put it up on the wall. So a lot of people like to spend some time trying to see who all they could see. Obviously, you got the names like Ken Griffey Jr., Derek Jeter, Ted Williams, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio. But then there are also, you know, a lot of lesser known players that have signed contracts with us whose names will be on that wall. So it's really kind of a fun experience to just search and see what you can find, see if maybe you can find a little nugget of baseball history that isn't much talked about. But, you know, there's definitely a lot to see on that wall.
And you've got an exhibit where folks can come in and you've got some game news bats from some of the legends, Babe Ruth, Johnny Bench, and others as well.
Yep.
The kids and, well, your visitors can come in and hold those bats.
Yeah. Right inside our gallery, the first exhibit that you'll really come across is our what we call our Hold a Piece of History exhibit. So it's exactly what it sounds like. You know, we have game news bats from every Major League team, plus a few more guys that you mentioned, Ken Griffey Jr., Babe Ruth, Johnny Bench, Roberto Clemente is one that we just added last summer. So guests actually have a chance to step up and hold these game-used bats that were used by these players, and they can, you know, take a picture with it, feel the different measurements. We've got, you know, best that range from 37, 38 ounces, which is what a lot of the guys that played back in the 1900s like to use. They like to use heavier bats, to some lighter bats of, you know, players from today's era.
And do you have, what else is in the permanent collection or permanent exhibits or activities there?
Yeah, so you'll see statues of some of those guys that I just mentioned. Roberto Clemente is one that we just added last summer. Jackie Robinson, you know, we've got statues of Babe Ruth, Ken Griffey Jr., Ted Williams, Derek Jeter. There are other bats on display. We have a couple of Johnny Bench artifacts on display from a couple of years ago. The bat that he used to hit his last career home run, one of his Gold Glove awards. There's a bat that Joe DiMaggio used during his 56-game hitting streak, which is a record that personally I believe will probably never be broken. The bat that Hank Aaron used to hit his 700th career home run, just the second player at the time when he was chasing Babe Ruth's all-time record. You know, we've got an exhibit about a old Louisville baseball team called the Louisville Unions. They were a pre-Negro Leagues team that played in Louisville for just a couple of seasons, and these were photographs that were sent to us a couple of years ago that we just honestly didn't really know anything about it, and so our curator kind of dug into them and really rediscovered this baseball team that seemed to be lost to history. So we've got a piece of the museum dedicated to them. Guests can see hand turning demonstrations, which is how we used to make our bats before we got into, you know, all the machines and automated processes. You can stare down a 90 mile per hour fastball, see what that looks like to hitters, you know, and then just tons of exhibits that talk about how we get our wood, just the process of making bats, how you know a certain bat is good to use by professional players. So really there's just a lot for, you know, baseball fans and even non-baseball fans to see in our museum, just a lot of history.
Do you host temporary or seasonal exhibits?
We do, yeah. Our most recent one that just opened, we have a collection curveballs exhibit. So this is, you know, a lot of things from our artifacts that have never been displayed publicly before, but that are just so cool that, you know, we couldn't keep them to ourselves any longer. You know, we've got a motorcycle wheel that was designed, it was for a motorcycle designed by Paul Jr., featured on American Chopper. The wheel has Louisville Slugger baseball bats in it. So that's a really cool feature of it. There's a bat throne that we made for Hank Aaron, made out of his bat. The top part of it has some mini bats too. So, he actually sat in that throne, I believe it was 2017 for an event. So that's one that has been displayed before, but is making a return. Other things that people haven't quite seen, you know, we got two giant, handmade quilts featuring the logos of all 30 major league teams, signed bats by musicians like Jack Harlow, Stevie Wonder, Ed Sheeran. There's a signed bat, a signed lightsaber bat by the cast of Clone Wars. Some hockey sticks that, you know, Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier signed. Just a lot of stuff in that exhibit that really hasn't ever been seen by anybody.
Does Louisville Slugger, in fact, produce hockey sticks as well then?
We do not anymore. We used to, but not anymore.
And does Louisville Slugger produce any other products other than baseball bats these days, or is it exclusively bats?
Well, Louisville Slugger only does baseball bats. Our company, Hillerick & Bradsby, that I mentioned earlier, does have another line of products called Bionic Gloves. They are gloves that are designed by a retired orthopedic hand specialist for activities like golfing, gardening, fitness, really just trying to make a more comfortable and ergonomic gloves to provide for a better experience when you're doing those activities that you love to do.
Do visitors have the opportunity to tour the factory and see the employees, see the manufacturing process in action?
Absolutely. We have factory tours 7 days a week. That's probably our biggest draw there, honestly. So about a 30-minute factory tour. We take you through how we get our wood from the forests in Pennsylvania and New York that we talked about earlier. Take you through how pro bats are made, how retail bats are made. We show you how we brand all of our bats, how we make our mini bats, and then guests actually get a free souvenir mini bat at the end of the tour when they're done.
What is the most expensive premium bat that Louisville Slugger produces?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm not sure about that one.
Are there some that get into the hundreds or maybe more?
For sure, yep, there are definitely some. In our museum store, we sell souvenir bats that we don't recommend for game use. Those range around $69 to $89. There are some usable bats that we can personalize in our museum store as well, and those get up closer to the $150, $160 range.
In high school and in college baseball, they typically don't use wooden bats. They use metal, aluminum bats. Does Louisville Slugger get into that market at all?
Yeah, we make some aluminum bats. Those are not made at our facility here in Louisville. All of our wood bats are made here in Louisville, but our aluminum bats are made out in California. But that is definitely something that we've done in the past. Actually, a funny story, since you mentioned aluminum bats, Derek Jeter used the exact same model, the P72 model, for his entire career. And the reason that he used that, he was here back in November, the reason he told us that he used that is because it felt just like his aluminum bat that he used in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So he picked up that P72 model wood bat and said it felt like what he was used to swinging, and he just swung it for the rest of his career. And we actually retired that bat model and renamed it the DJ2 in honor of him when he retired in 2014.
Do you get a lot of celebrity visits, baseball stars that visit?
Yeah, we actually have a spot on our CNC machine, which is what makes all of our pro bats, that guests can see when they're on a factory tour of all the players, not all the players, but a lot of the players that have come in to visit us over the years. They actually sign that CNC machine. So we've got guys on there like Josh Hamilton, Steve Garvey was actually just here over this past weekend. He was in town for Derby and stopped by. Derek Jeter signed it when he was here. Just a lot of other players over the years that have stopped by that love to sign that machine. Frank Thomas, Johnny Bench, all those guys.
Is Louisville, Kentucky, would that be Cincinnati Reds fans primarily, team loyalty?
Well, you see a mix. You see a mix between Reds fans, Cubs fans. There are some Guardians fans that are represented here, White Sox, Cardinals, just kind of being in the middle of all of those.
Yeah.
Teams. I would say it's majority Reds and Cubs fans, but it's definitely a mix. You know, the Reds AAA team is located here in Louisville as well, the Louisville Bats.
Well, and before we wrap up, can you tell us a little bit about your location and not only visiting the museum, but the experience that visitors can have in downtown Louisville or in the Louisville area?
Yeah, so we are on what's called Museum Row. It's an historic stretch. You know, there's tons of other museums, the Muhammad Ali Center, Fraser Museum, Kentucky Science Center. You mentioned earlier about bourbon. There's a lot of bourbon along Main Street. We actually just opened a bourbon experience of our own right next door called Barrels and Billets. So it plays off of, you know, kind of billets are what we use to make the bats. They're cylindrical pieces of wood that we get from our forests. So it kind of plays off of that piece of the manufacturing process. But yeah, a lot to see in downtown Louisville. You mentioned the Kentucky Derby Museum and Churchill Downs, obviously. And then yeah, if you're coming in the dead of summer, definitely catch a Louisville Bats baseball game and you can really make a fun day out of Louisville.
All right. Well, very good. It has been a pleasure, Nick. I want to thank you for spending some time with us today. Any final thoughts or other tidbits you'd like to share with us before we wrap up today?
No, I don't think so. You know, I just appreciate you having me on, and any chance that I can talk about our great history that we have here and the fun that we have here, you know, I'm all over it. So appreciate you having me on, and hope to see some visitors from you all.
Thanks for being with us. That is Nick Fuchs from the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory in Louisville, Kentucky. We'll be back here in just a moment.
At Papa John's Pizza, get a large specialty pizza for just $15, carry out or delivery. To order, call 740-623-8483 or order online at pjz.com. And remember, Papa John's new location, 439 Cambridge Road.
MVHC Urgent Care provides health care without the wait. Their locations offer extended hours and are fully equipped with X-ray and lab services. You do not have to be an MVHC patient to utilize their urgent care services. Visit one of their convenient locations in Coshocton for all of your urgent health care needs.
At Dean's Jewelry, we believe jewelry tells a story.
Whether it's the epic novel of a family heirloom passed down through generations,
or a romantic tale of the six-month dateversary necklace he bought you last week,
every story deserves to be told. And when you're ready to add a chapter to yours, commemorate the moment with a beautiful piece of jewelry from Dean's.
You won't find any plot twists here, just upfront pricing and full disclosure on everything we do.
Continue your story at Dean's Jewelry, Coshocton and Mount Vernon.
Attention all dogs in the listening area. Good Boy Bakery invites you to stop by our shop in Roscoe Village to check out all the goodies and other fun canine items we have in stock. You'll find everything from home-style dog treats made right here in our own kitchen to codfish skins, water buffalo horns, ostrich bones, and more. Sounds pretty cool, huh? And remember, dogs, our Good Boy Bakery stores in Coshocton and Cambridge are human-friendly. That's right. You can bring your person with you. You can also have your human help you log on to our Facebook page or our website, goodboybakery.com, for more information. Hurry up, pups, while the waffles are warm.
If you turn 65 this year, you are eligible for Medicare. To help you understand your choices and possibility of financial assistance, the Ohio Department of Insurance is holding Welcome to Medicare events across the state. So join us at a free event near you. Make sure your plan suits your budget and your needs. For more information, contact the Ohio Department of Insurance at 1-800-686-1578 or go online at insurance.ohio.gov.
Do you or any of your family members, neighbors, or friends own a property that you just want to be done with it? If so, call TurboTrack Realty today for an all-cash offer at 614-470-2000, 614-470-2000. Would it be convenient for you to take what you wanted and leave the rest behind? Great, I'll buy it. Call 614-470-2000. That's 614-470-2000.
Wilson Carpet and Furniture is your Coshocton dealer for Graber window blinds. You can choose from a large variety of quality custom-made window coverings that range from soft fabric cellular shades to solar and roller shades. Stop into Wilson Carpet and Furniture, 230 Main Street, Coshocton, for your perfect window dressing, Graber blinds, and take advantage of Graber's current free cordless lift promotion and their Shades of Summer rebate.
To thank all customers, Keim Home Center is holding the annual Customer Appreciation Day sale on May 16 to 21, and tolls will be 12% off. That means tolls from DeWalt, Makita, Milwaukee, along with many of our specialty brands. During the sale, you will also find deals on many stock and special order items from across the store. We hope to see you at Keim Home Center May 16 to 21 for the Customer Appreciation Day sale. Learn more at KeimHome.com. And as always, thanks for choosing Keim.
WTNS is looking for the right person to join our team. If you want to help local businesses with their marketing needs, we want to talk with you. If you want to learn more, find out by calling me, Chris Wallace, at 622-1560 or by emailing your information to WTNS993@yahoo.com. Again, that's WTNS993@yahoo.com. WTNS AM/FM is an equal opportunity employer.
Coshocton Regional Medical Center is committed to prioritizing the safety of our patients. That promise of better care is reflected in our achievement of a Leapfrog Hospital Safety Grade A for safety excellence and a top 10% ranking for patient safety in the nation from Health Grades 2 years in a row. We strive to be the gold standard of care and have demonstrated that pledge to every patient with our commitment to patient safety. Coshocton Regional Medical Center, where care matters most.
Call a Jeff Turner Ford Sports Line at 623-9867. Hi, I'm Jamie Rice. Join us for our Memorial Day sale with $2,500 minimum for your trade-in during the month of May. Only at Jeff Turner Ford.
This look at the weather is brought to you by Edie's Homestyle Diner at 611 Main Street. Now open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. At Edie's Homestyle Diner, they offer daily specials and feature Miss Edie's delicious homemade pies. For carryout orders, call 740-623-8131 or meet some friends and family at 611 Main Street for a homestyle meal and dessert.
Sunshine today and lots of it, and it's going to be warm once again with high temperatures in the lower 80s. For tonight, clear, lows in the lower 50s, and for tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Currently, it is 56 degrees in Coshocton. Maybe a sliver of open phone lines toward the end of our program today, but maybe not, probably not, because we have some interesting local history, ancient history to talk about here for the rest of our program. Last week, Jen Bush, the director of the Johnson Hummerkaus Museum, with us. We talked about a wide variety of different things, but one of those was the Newark Earthworks and the pending designation as a World Heritage Site, which is a pretty big deal, and we'll get to that here in just a moment. Our guests this morning are Jen Altman. She's the Director of Historic Sites and Museums for the Ohio History Connection, and also Dr. Brad Lepper, and he is a Senior Archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection. And good morning, Brad. Jen, thank you both for being here today.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Brad, I'd like to get a little bit of a background, your background in archaeology. What are some of the other projects or research that you've been involved with before this?
Sure. Over the years, I spent most of my career working for the Ohio History Connection, and in that capacity, I've worked as the curator and site archaeologist for the Newark Earthworks in Flint Ridge. And at that time, I helped excavate the Burning Tree Mastodon back in the day. And then I was transferred to the main headquarters in Columbus, and I've worked on the helping to design the exhibits for the Ford Ancient Museum and the exhibits at the Great Circle at Newark.
How did you get into archaeology to begin with? Because to me, that just sounds like a great deal of fun and an exciting career. Is that? First of all, is that accurate?
It varies. Okay. There are lots of days that are exactly what you described.
But where does your passion come from?
Yeah, and it's an embarrassing question for me because I don't remember. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I've wanted to be an archaeologist. I don't know. I must have seen a book somewhere or seen some kind of documentary when I was a kid. Reading National Geographic, certainly, as a kid, got me interested in this kind of thing. But no, as far back as I can remember, this is what I've wanted to do.
What was the circumstances that led you to focus on the Newark Earthworks?
Well, I kind of backed into that. As I said, I was studying in college the early Ice Age people, like the ones that killed the Burning Tree Mastodon, probably. But when I graduated, there were no jobs for an Ice Age archaeologist, and it turned out that there was a job opening at the Ohio History Connection at the Newark Earthworks. And I had certainly studied the ancient indigenous Hopewell culture in college and in grad school. So I knew about him, but I applied for the job and was lucky to get it and have been there ever since.
Before we get to the specifics of the Newark Earthworks, can you give us a little background of the Hopewell culture and the time frame and the people that we're talking about?
Sure. This ancient American Indian culture lived in this area, southern Ohio especially, between about A.D. 1 and 400. And so that's more or less contemporary with the Roman Empire over in the Old World. It's interesting. They built these gigantic earthworks like the ones at Newark and at Fort Ancient and the ones in Chillicothe, but they didn't live in cities. They didn't grow fields of corn. They lived in very small communities that were isolated from one another, but they would periodically gather together at these earthwork sites to build them and to worship there. But their communities consisted of maybe a homestead, really, a garden. They did have agriculture, but not corn. They raised local crops like sunflower and squash. They hunted and gathered and fished. But they didn't have a high level, what we would call a very sophisticated culture. I mean, it was certainly a sophisticated culture, but it wasn't very what we call a complex society. They had no rulers. There was no king or queen.
Yeah.
So whatever brought them together at these monumental sites was something different than a pharaoh telling them that, you know, he or she wanted them to build these giant earthworks. It had to be some inspiring message that got all these people, got their passion aroused and got them to do these amazing things.
And so the Newark Earthworks, if I'm understanding correctly, there was no permanent settlement or site there. It was a gathering place.
Yeah, it was a huge cathedral that periodically became a gathering place for probably hundreds, if not thousands, of ancient indigenous Americans.
So from how far away did they come?
Well, one clue lies in the artifacts that are found in some of the mounds. And there are seashells from the Gulf of Mexico. There's copper from the upper Great Lakes. And there's even obsidian, which is a kind of a volcanic glass. Mm-hmm. Every volcano has its own particular chemical fingerprint. Most of the obsidian found in Hopewell Culture mounds comes from Yellowstone Park in Wyoming.
Okay. So 2,000 years ago, we had people traveling 2,000 miles to come here?
I think that's true, yes. I think, you know, we used to have this old advertising slogan, Ohio, the heart of it all. 2,000 years ago, it was the heart of it all for North America.
So how many different peoples would gather together at the Newark Earthworks?
We don't know. We don't know what the different tribes were back then, although there certainly were tribes back then, tribal nations just as there are today. Certainly many different groups came speaking different languages. And that may be why the Hopewell ceremonial regalia includes such amazing symbols. There are all kinds of symbols. There are bear canine teeth. There are copper cutouts of falcons, deer claw or deer paw, deer antlers. So all these things must have had a lot of symbolic value that would have communicated the status of people as they came to the sites for these gatherings. Even though they didn't speak the same language, the symbols they were wearing would have conveyed information that would have helped them interact with one another.
To me, that's quite a thought that people are traveling that far, different cultures, speaking different languages 2,000 years ago, and coming together for what's apparently a common purpose.
Yeah, and it seems to be a religious purpose. This seems to be like Mecca or like Jerusalem, a gathering place that was primarily religious in motivation.
Through your research, can you gather the nature of the religious or the belief systems that we're talking about?
Probably not in detail, because there's no written records. There's no equivalent to a Bible or a Quran, but through the regalia, through the burial practices that we see, most of these places were focuses of mortuary activity. People are buried in mounds at these places, but not all the mounds are burial mounds. That's a very common misconception. Mm-hmm. At Newark, there were about a dozen burial mounds, all enclosed in an oval enclosure, but the Great Circle, the Circle and Octagon, those have no burials associated with them. Those are primarily sacred areas that would be, you know, like different parts of the cathedral where different things would happen other than burial.
And so seashells from the Gulf of Mexico, obsidian from Wyoming, from Yellowstone Park. What have been some of the other artifacts that have been discovered and researched?
Well, at various places, the obsidian in particular was researched. The Seneca tribe actually helped finance study of some amazing obsidian artifacts. They are things that look like spear points, but they're like a foot long. I mean, they're about the size of dinner plates, gigantic symbols of spear points, if you will. And we wondered if, you know, it seemed obvious that they wouldn't be used for anything because they're made out of glass. If you tried to throw that spear point as big as it was, it would shatter. But we looked with microscopes at the edges to see if there was evidence that they'd been actually used to butcher animals or something. And we found out, no, they had not been used for anything. These were just powerful, evocative symbols used in their ceremonies. And at some point, they broke them all into pieces and buried them in ceremonial deposits in the mounds.
Were there any artworks or decorative?
This is a statewide test of the Ohio Emergency Alert System, originating from the State Emergency Operations Center in Columbus. This is only a test. The Ohio Emergency Alert System has been designed to provide the public with timely warnings and emergency information. Had this been an actual emergency, you would have received instructions and information related to that emergency over this and other stations in your area. This concludes this test of the Ohio Emergency Alert System.
Once again, the emergency alert system, very important to know that they are in place and it's working in the time of emergency, but they don't tell us when that's going to happen. So we are back once again with Dr. Brad Lepper, a senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection. We're talking about the Newark Earthworks and a pending designation as a World Heritage Site. We'll get to that here in just a moment. But before the alert test there, Brad, I asked you about artwork and symbolism and what types of art and aesthetics did you find?
Yeah, it's incredible in the variety. I can't even encompass some of the mica was carved into the shapes of open hands or claws from a raptor, a hawk, or an eagle. One of the most interesting sets of artifacts is it consists of five perfectly round spherical stones, about the size of marbles, and they have these abstract engravings on them. And what's fascinating about this is the archaeologists that dug them up back in the 1920s figured they were marbles because that's about the size they were. But American Indians didn't play the game of marbles before the historic period, so that seems to be a big question. Well, I was in consultation with some American Indian tribes in Oklahoma, and at the Eastern Shawnee Museum, they were showing me the ceremonial drum. There was an exhibit about it. And Chief Ben Barnes with the Shawnee tribe was walking by, and he started talking about their water drum, their sacred water drum that they use in their ceremonies, has a leather hide that they attach to the body of the drum using perfectly round black stones that they wrap around the leather, then tie them up. And I said, well, that's interesting. And I told him about the stones that had been found in the site mound, which is one of the World Heritage Sites in Chillicothe. And we actually started collaborating together and wrote a scientific paper on, we think those stones are not marbles, of course. We think they're actually drum stones used in the ceremonial drums of the Hopewell culture. And this would be one of the oldest drums, probably the oldest drum we know of in Eastern North America.
How large are the Newark earthworks? How much, how many artifacts or how much stuff is there?
Well, it's architecture that's there today.
Okay.
And the burial mounds were all destroyed during the early history of Newark. But the architecture is immense. I mean, the Great Circle is 1,200 feet across. That's four football fields. The circle and octagon, the octagon earth by itself is 50 acres. You could put four Roman Colosseums inside just the octagon. And it's attached to a circle that's 1,054 feet in diameter. So the Great Circle is 1,200 feet in diameter. The circle that's connected to the octagon is 1,054. You could put the smaller circle inside it. In Circleville, which there used to be two circles inside each other that were the exact same diameter as Newark circles, 1,200 and 1,054 feet. There's nothing really left in Circleville now except the name of the town to tell you there were circles there.
That's how Circleville got its name, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Round town, we used to call it. So are there any specific projects or lines of research right now concerning the Newark earthworks and learning more about it?
Absolutely. We're always trying to learn more about it. We're looking at archives, finding new maps that, you know, that were done back in the 1800s. We have a real problem with the Newark earthworks in that so much of it's been destroyed. So how do you learn about a site when most of it is occupied by a city? Well, one of the ways you do that is look in the archives and look for old maps, look for accounts of people who were there back in the 1800s who saw it, and learn from that and get more insights from that.
And it is located on, it would be the western side of Newark, and it's within the city limits, right?
Absolutely. The Great Circle, the northern part of the park is in Newark. The southern part is in Heath.
Okay.
And it's right on State Route 79.
Okay.
The Circle and Octagon is just off of Main Street in western Newark, south of 16.
And there is a golf course currently on top of it?
Currently, there is a golf course on top of it. That's one of the ways the site has become preserved over the years. But it's right now it's an impediment to World Heritage. It's an impediment to public access. And the Ohio History Connection is working hard to try to get that situation resolved so that it can be full public access again.
But if it weren't for the golf course, there's the possibility that it could have been developed in other ways and bulldozed and destroyed like some of the other things you mentioned.
There is that possibility. Yeah.
Okay. Our guest is Brad Lepper, archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection. And we will talk about the I'll call it pending designation as a World Heritage Site and what has to happen for that designation to come to pass. We'll be back with Dr. Lepper once again right after these words.
Soybean cyst nematode are gaining ground throughout Ohio. In this Best of Voice of Soy, brought to you by Ohio soybean farmers and their checkoff dollars, Horacio Lopez-Nicora with Ohio State University shares how checkoff investments are helping farmers tackle these yield-robbing pests.
First of all, to detect if they have soybean cyst nematode. If they do, then the next question is, well, how much do I have? The results that the growers will receive will be a table indicating the numbers of soybean cyst nematode per 100 cc of soil and what the number means. More than 60% of these fields tested positive for the presence of soybean cyst nematode. However, if we grab these numbers that are very alarming, then we realize that the majority of these samples really have levels that are very low and will not cause significant yield reduction if we do take a management approach.
For more Voice of Soy programs, visit brownfieldagnews.com.
The reasons to treat yourself to a frozen drink from McDonald's go on and on and on. It's more than a drink. It's a McDonald's drink.
Cool off with the delicious new Tropical Mango Slushy. Or try a frozen Coke, frozen Fanta Blue Raspberry, or Minute Maid Strawberry Watermelon Slushy. Now that's a refreshing way to treat yourself.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. I participate in McDonald's. Coca-Cola is a registered trademark of the Coca-Cola Company.
This look at the weather is brought to you by 26 Truck Repair. 26 Truck Repair offers a full-service diesel repair shop. They also carry Interstate batteries, Fleet Guard filters, hydraulic hoses, and many other parts. Call 26 Truck Repair at 740-202-2350 to schedule an appointment.
Sunshine today, warm with highs in the lower 80s. For tonight, clear with lows in the lower 50s. And tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Currently, it is 56 degrees in Coshocton. And we are back once again with Brad Lepper from the Ohio History Connection, a senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program. And Brad, what is a World Heritage Site and what is UNESCO?
Well, a World Heritage Site, it's sponsored by UNESCO, and UNESCO is the United Nations Scientific and Cultural Organization. And among the things they do is this World Heritage Program that recognizes sites around the world that have significance, not just of local significance, not just of, you know, significance for the nation as a whole, but world significance. And to have that level of significance, it must have what they call outstanding universal value. And that kind of speaks for itself. I mean, things like the Grand Canyon, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, the Roman Colosseum, and so on. Those things are part of the world's heritage, not just, you know, the heritage of those individual countries. But the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks, we think, has outstanding universal value in that it tells a unique story about the ancient American Indians that lived here, that these, unlike almost everywhere else in the world where you have monumental architecture, almost all those places had kings or pharaohs that could order the construction, and they lived in cities, and they had farming, so they, or agriculture, so they could feed hundreds of workers and things. But in the Ohio Valley at around AD 1, you know, these little communities, without some overarching authority telling them to do it, gathered at these places and built monumental architecture on a scale and with geometrical and astronomical knowledge encoded in that architecture that rivals anything else in the world. So that story, that this monumental architecture created by indigenous American Indians is here. It's not like architecture elsewhere. It's not made of stone. It's not like thrusting up into the sky like Stonehenge or the Roman architecture. It sprawls across the landscape for miles sometimes, and it's a whole different conception of architecture, really.
Is the Newark Earthworks, then, is it unique? Are there other similar types of sites around the country, around the world?
Well, it's the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks are unique. There are mounds in other parts of North America, later cultures. Cahokia Mounds in Illinois is another World Heritage Site. That was a city during the Mississippian period, and that's like around 1000 AD. And there's a giant pyramid with a flat top in the center of it, and rulers would live on top of that and, you know, rule over the city beneath it. And there were many, many other mounds. But that was built, again, under very different social conditions, with a chief or a king almost there. So there are different kinds of mounds, but the mounds of the Hopo culture are unique. But as I mentioned, that some of them are like the mounds that were in Circleville were very much like the mounds mm-hmm. at Newark. But Newark was the biggest connected set of geometric earthworks.
For perspective, about how many, what other World Heritage sites do we have here in the state of Ohio, if any?
None.
Okay. And what about in the United States? You mentioned Cahokia. You mentioned the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, there's a number of them in the United States. There's, we think, in addition to the Cahokia, there's Poverty Point in Louisiana, which is another indigenous American Indian site that's much older than the Hopewell. So in some ways, the Hopewell sort of fills in the gap between these early mounds in Louisiana and the much later mounds in the Mississippi Valley.
Are World Heritage sites concentrated in areas that, I don't know, would be considered Western culture, or are they evenly scattered throughout the world, in China and other exotic places, et cetera?
They are all over the world, but I do think there are concentrations in sort of where you'd expect them, in Italy and Greece and places like that, that do sort of maybe bias Western culture a bit. But the whole point of World Heritage is that it encompasses the entire world. All the cultures.
What are the criteria to be designated a World Heritage Site?
There are a number of different criteria. There's like seven, I think. I know most well the two that we've used to nominate the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks. One is that they are masterpieces of human creative genius, and I think we can demonstrate that. And the other is that it's a testimony to a unique culture. So, and I think we've demonstrated that the Hopewell culture was quite unique as well.
How did the ball get rolling, the process get started to apply for World Heritage Site designation?
Well, for years, a lot of us thought the Hopewell Earthworks deserved that honor, but it actually was, 10 or 20 years ago, the Ohio, or not the Ohio Department, the National Department of the Interior of the United States has a tentative list. That's basically a short list of sites that they used to pick from to nominate to sites for World Heritage. And they announced that they were redoing their list and were accepting new nominations. And a lot of us got excited about that and said, we need to nominate the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks to see if it can get on that tentative list.
What was your role in the process?
Well, I worked with the folks at the National Park Service, Hopewell Culture National Historical Park, and other staff at the Ohio History Connection to write the argument for why we deserve to be on that list. And the Department of the Interior said, yep, you guys definitely deserve to be on the list. And it's taken a long time for us to be nominated off that list, which was a little frustrating. But that's a process.
Well, the designation is not in place just yet, but what are your thoughts on the prospect or the likelihood that it will ultimately happen?
I'm convinced that it should happen. The sites are worthy, but as with any process that has this political element, you never really know. So, no, it's not a World Heritage Site yet. It's been nominated. It's working through the process. We'll have folks come out to visit the sites to evaluate them in person to see, you know, they've read our dossier, our document, our proposal for why these should be World Heritage Sites. And now they're going to come and visit the sites and evaluate them in person and then go back to UNESCO and say, yes, we agree these sites deserve inscription on the list, or no, we don't agree.
So these are folks from UNESCO that will come and evaluate, check it out themselves, and then...
They're actually from a separate organization that's called ICOMOS, the International Committee for Monuments and Sites. But they're like the technical group that have the expertise to evaluate the sites. So they'll pick somebody from there that's more familiar with this area that will come and evaluate the sites and then tell UNESCO what their recommendation is.
Do you get the sense that we are close to the designation, that it's imminent, or can you even evaluate that?
If everything goes well, we'll be inscribed in 2 years.
And what does that mean for the Newark Earthworks? What does it mean for Newark? What does it mean for our region to have a World Heritage Site right here in our backyard?
It means a lot of things. I mean, but for me, the most important thing is that it means these sites of this ancient indigenous culture that lives in Ohio are going to be lifted up and recognized on the same stage as the Great Pyramid of Egypt and Stonehenge. They'll be seen as that kind of cultural achievement. But of course, a lot of people are interested in the economic impact. And we've done economic studies that show communities that have World Heritage Sites in them, or states that have World Heritage Sites in them, can get a big boost in tourism that results in new jobs and a boost to the economy.
Okay. Are there people out there that make World Heritage Sites a priority when they travel? For me, it's national parks. Are there those that go around and have a bucket list of World Heritage Sites?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. People from all over the world will be coming to places like Newark. And for me, the neat thing about that is a lot of people in Newark drive right by the earthworks and pay mm-hmm. no attention to them, like thinking, well, it's in Newark, it can't be anything important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see it from 16 on the way to Columbus, yeah.
Absolutely. But I think when people see the world coming to visit these sites, they'll say, wow, maybe we do have something important right here in our own backyard.
Well, what the listeners can't see is the twinkle in your eye when you talk about that. and so this is exciting, obviously, for you and the archaeology community.
Yes.
All right. So World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection, Dr. Brad Lauper is the senior archaeologist, and we'll get our national international news from the Associated Press and return with Brad Lepper and also Jen Altman from Ohio History Connection after this.
This is AP News. I'm Rita Foley. You don't need us to tell you this. Consumer prices are up. They jumped 8.3% last month from 12 months earlier. But that's actually a sign that inflation is slowing. Listen to the AP's Sagar Magani.
After 7 months of gains, inflation slowed last month. Consumer prices were still up 8.3% from a year earlier, but that's below the 8.5% year-over-year surge in March, which was the highest rate since 1981. On a month-to-month basis, prices rose 0.3% from March to April, still elevated, but the smallest jump in 8 months. Ongoing price hikes remain a financial problem for households and a major political one for President Biden.
Later today, the Senate will vote on an abortion bill. The AP's Mike Gracia says we may already know how this vote's going to turn out.
A test vote is scheduled in the Senate today on a Democratic bill to protect access to abortions. But the vote will be mostly symbolic, and it is expected to fail. The House passed the Women's Health Protection Act last year, but it's been held up in the Senate by a Republican filibuster. In the wake of last week's leak of a Supreme Court draft that indicated the landmark Roe v. Wade decision might be overturned later this year, today's Senate vote is largely about putting members on record.
A Russian ship believed to be carrying stolen grain from Ukraine has docked in Syria. Ukraine has alleged that the ship had thousands of tons of grains Russia stole from the country. Israel now says it's unclear who fired the bullet that killed an Al Jazeera journalist this morning in the West Bank. This backs away from earlier claims the Palestinian militants might have been responsible for killing Shireen Abu Akla. A Kentucky woman accused of stabbing to death her two children has pleaded not guilty to murder charges. This is AP News. There's a little something unusual about the way a lot of people watch the Kentucky Derby, which was run over the weekend. The AP's Oscar Wells Gabriel has this.
An interesting TV tidbit from Saturday's Kentucky Derby. It's said that seeing is believing, and that appears to be the reason for a big spike in viewership for the Run for the Roses. The spike in question came not during the Kentucky Derby, but after it. It appears people wanted to see if it was true that 80-1 long shot Rich Strike actually won the race. And that added up to more people watching replays of the race than watched the Derby live. NBC said some 36 million people watched the finish on its social media accounts, while live Derby coverage was seen by an average of 16 million on the network and on its streaming service, Peacock. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Authorities will not file criminal charges against former heavyweight Mike Tyson after he was seen punching a fellow passenger on a plane at the airport in San Francisco. I'm Rita Foley, AP News.
It It is 9 minutes after 10 o'clock, and we are back once again with Dr. Brad Lepper, the senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection. And, Brad, how much speaking do you do? Obviously, you do quite a bit of it, but how many? I know you've been here at the museum before.
Yeah, and I enjoy, I mean, one of my big jobs, I think, for the Ohio History Connection is to be, you know, a public educator, not just sort of a scientist that works over in the corner going excavating sites, but one that reaches out and does public education. And I really enjoy that part of my job. And I'm on the Ohio Humanities Speakers Bureau, so organizations can, you know, contact them, and I can come give local talks, too.
Now, you mentioned during the break there, during the news, that the Newark Earthworks is one component of the World Heritage Site designation.
Yeah. The Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks is what's called a serial nomination. That means it combines a number of sites. The Newark Earthworks is my favorite part of the nomination because, of course, I've been working there for 30 years. But there are other very important parks, other very important parts of the story that are told by these other sites. For example, the Fort Ancient Earthworks in Warren County is a gigantic hilltop enclosure. Newark are geometric enclosures built in geometric shapes. This giant hilltop enclosure at Fort Ancient is like 3.5 miles of earthen walls that surround this hilltop. And, of course, the name suggests it's not a ceremonial place but a fort. And that was, or people in the 1800s had a misconception that because it was on the top of a high hill and had walls around it, it must be a fort. But archaeological work over the years has shown that it, too, is part of this ceremonial complex, but it's a different kind of ceremonial site because of where it is. And then in Chillicothe, there are 5 sites that make up Hopewell Culture National Historical Park. And this was the real center of the Hopewell culture. The late Nomi Grieber, an archaeologist, a Hopewell specialist that was at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, said that the Hopewell Earthworks in Chillicothe were the center of this explosion of art, ritual, and ceremony and architecture that sort of erupted around AD 1 in southern Ohio.
Sort of a North American Renaissance, eh?
Exactly.
Okay. And you mentioned several times about the architecture and the, I guess, sophisticated maybe the geometry that went into it. Was that discovery and putting it on a timeline, did that indicate that they were, the people of the time were maybe a lot farther ahead than we gave them credit for?
Absolutely. We have sort of characterized American Indians over the years as savages, as people that were, you know, just living in you know, teepees and huts, but no, the technology, for example, that they used to build these mounds was very simple, pointed sticks and baskets. But the knowledge that's encoded in these places is not simple. They understood how to make circles and squares with the same area on a huge scale. They aligned the circle and octagon to the rising and setting points of the moon that varies over an 18.6-year-long cycle. So they'd been observing the moon carefully. They knew where it rose and set at particular times and aligned their earthworks to those moon rises. Other Hopewell earthworks are aligned to the sun, the summer solstice, the winter solstice, and so on. So I think it's not that these were astronomical observatories. It's these were sacred places. And by aligning them to the sun and the moon, it made them more sacred.
And again, the purpose of the Newark Earthworks, religious or spiritual in nature, believed to be.
Absolutely. That's our best guess based on all the data information we have now. The Hopewell sites are not cities. They're not forts. They're cathedrals.
Today, and Jen, you might want to get on this here, but what can folks, when folks visit the Newark Earthworks in Newark, what do they see? Mm-hmm. What can you see and do there?
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me on. So today, I think a lot of people know the Great Circle is really available anytime. People can park and walk up, and it's just a beautiful sight. It's so interesting, I think, at the Great Circle, how when you walk into the circular enclosure, you know you're in the middle of the city, but it all sort of falls away, and it's a very serene place. So a lot of people come to walk. We have a small museum there that we're working on sort of coming back from COVID hours on that. So check out ohiohistory.org, and we'll be updating ours as things come back into fuller swing. But I would really just recommend people come and spend time at the sites. So at the Great Circle, you can access at any time. We have a little, working with a partner organization, have a little storybook trail right now for kids. That's a series of signs and a story on those that they can follow through. And then over at the Octagon Earthworks, there is a public area, a parking area that is always accessible. And there's a little observation platform that people can come up and overlook the octagon and some signage. So that part of that site is always accessible. And just encourage people to come and see the sites, experience them. And I think that's the thing, is when you're at a place like the Great Circle and you walk into this enormous entrance to this earthwork that's 1,200 feet across, you really do feel like you're transported to a different place. And it connects us with the fact that the people who built them because it was incredibly important to them. So it's just a really peaceful place that a lot of people enjoy walking and just sitting and enjoying.
Would a World Heritage Site designation, when it happens, will that provide any funding or anything to for a visitor center to help for preserve it and share it with the public in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So World Heritage designation itself does not come with a bunch of funding. But what we know is that investments, you know, when states or communities have a site that's added to the World Heritage List, it often brings additional investment from that state, from the community. And so we would anticipate and hope, you know, our hope for the long term is to be able to have more visitor amenities, to be able to have a larger museum space to share the really incredible story that's there.
I want to talk more about the Ohio history connection here in just a little bit. Mm-hmm. But Brad, back to the Ohio Earthworks. What's the nature of the research that goes into to determining what was in there? And you know, we talk about, this isn't a burial mound, but what type of research can be done in order to be respectful for a burial mound or other things, and still, you know, still dig around?
Yeah, that's a great question, because and things have changed over the course of my career. Back in 1992, for example, we excavated a trench across the Great Circle to help to understand how it was built, to see if it was built in stages or if it was built all at once. And we learned a lot about that. We learned, first of all, that it was built on a prairie, which is really interesting, because we used to think it was an entire forest, and they had to use axes and clear the trees from 4.5 square miles to be able to build these earthworks. But the fact is, America wasn't a wilderness 2,000 years ago. Indigenous Americans were managing the environment and burning off forests and keeping prairies open, because a forest doesn't have very many deer in it, but a forest with lots of prairie openings has lots of deer. So the Hopewell, when they came to Newark, were taking advantage of what was already an open space and built the earthworks there. And other things we learned from that excavation were that they built using different kinds of soil and different colors. So we think the earthwork was built in three stages, that they determined the center point and then pulled that 600-foot-long cord out and then built a small mound and then dug the ditch, because there's a ditch inside the circle, and then used sort of the dark brown topsoil from that, piling it on top of the mound, but leaving a gap. So they have this dark brown circular wall with a gap and then the ditch. And then they got bright yellow-brown subsoil and piled it on top of, and then on top of it inside the dark circle, and then carried it down to the edge of the ditch, so that when it was first constructed, you'd see the outside of the circle and it would be this dark brown color. And then when you walked into the circle, it would be bright yellow-brown. And I don't know whether that color was part of the architectural presentation, but... or maybe, you know, the grass was allowed to grow over it, and maybe it was just that those colors were important to have the magic work there. But so that excavation, to do that today, we would want to do that in consultation with our American Indian partners. And some of them may regard that as desecrating the mound, to mm-hmm. doing something bad. So times have changed, and we're changing with them, and we're increasingly involving our American Indian partners in wanting to know what kinds of research questions they have that we mm-hmm. can use. And also now there's all kinds of techniques that you can use to explore mounds without damaging them. Run, you know, ground penetrating radar, you know, magnetometry, so you can kind of like see under the ground without harming it. And doing that at like the Hopewell ceremonial sites in Chillicothe, they're finding traces of all kinds of other structures that were there that we don't think about. We think of these places as purely earthworks, but in fact there were wooden structure, wood hinges, circles of wooden posts, houses, small shrines or temples made out of wood, all kinds of things there 2,000 years ago that have left no visible traces today, but there are traces that can be found with certain scientific instruments.
The guest last week at the Johnson Humringhouse Museum, speaking on the Newark earthworks, he employed a method, sonar, that was non-intrusive to do research. My question is, how much 21st century technology like that, how big of a part of that is archaeological research, or do you use backhoes and shovels?
It depends on the problem you're trying to address, and all of that technology can be used. But increasingly now, we're using that remote sensing technology, and they're using it a lot at Hopewell Culture National Historical Park in cooperation with the German Archaeological Institute, in fact, to do remote sensing surveys for all the entire properties. And that helps you learn a lot about it, but it also helps you manage it. So you don't want to build a new parking lot in an area that might have important archaeological remains on it. So having this sort of X-ray of the whole site allows you to make good management decisions too.
How visible or how much resolution do you get from the sonar and being able to see underground?
Well, I'm not an expert. Dr. Jared Burks, who is the expert on that. But it varies. You can use sort of a broad survey and get a broad view, or you can sort of make the intervals between your lines shorter and get a much sharper view. And, of course, that technology is always improving. So whereas 10 years ago you may have gotten a blurry picture, now you're getting a much more sharp image of what's under there.
You mentioned an archaeological society or an organization from Germany. How much international collaboration do you have on projects such as this?
Well, that's unusual, but we think when we become a World Heritage Site, it will bring more international attention, and maybe we'll have more international partnerships at some of these sites.
Okay. Do archaeologists have conventions and events where you all get together and chat about archaeology?
We absolutely do.
All right. Well, our guest today, Dr. Brad Lepper, he is an archaeologist, senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at the Ohio History Connection. We'll take a break and be back with Dr. Lepper and also Jen Altman from Ohio History Connection right after these words.
When it comes to cereal disease protection, Prosaro Pro 400 SC fungicide from Bayer makes all the difference. With three effective active ingredients for overlapping control of foliar and head diseases, and a flexible application window for head scab, is formulated to lower DON, protect yield potential, and promote superior grain quality. Prosaro Pro. The future of plant health starts here. Visit ProsaroPro.com to learn more. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
If they don't have it, you don't need it. Otsego Carryout in Coshocton is the only stop for whatever you need. Check out their deli, meat and cheese, a freshly made grab-and-go sandwich, and a large selection of Walnut Creek favorites. Otsego Carryout has these new items. Walnut Creek Strawberry Cheesecake Cake Roll, sold by the roll or slice. A new variety of Walnut Creek Potato Chips. All Beef Bologna. Chicken Salad. Rotisserie Chicken Deli Meat. Colby Swiss Swirl Cheese. Troyer's Trail Bologna Sandwich Size. Baked Potato Salad with Bacon. And Buffalo Chicken Pasta Salad. Stop by Otsego Carryout today. If they don't have it, you don't need it.
Get the local weather forecast by calling the Jeff Drennan Ford Weather Service 24 hours a day at 622-0194. Our Memorial Day sale is going on the whole month of May with $2,500 minimum for your trade-in only at Jeff Drennan Ford, South 2nd Street in Coshocton.
Mayday, mayday, mayday! No, my ship's not sinking, but DeRusso's Sausage is coming this week. Just when you thought you couldn't make it any longer, DeRusso's is coming to your rescue. Arriving at Han Oil, today through Friday from 11 to 7, serving those delicious DeRusso sausage sandwiches and fresh squeezed lemonade. Nothing better than a day in May with a DeRusso sausage.
At Papa John's Pizza, get a large specialty pizza for just $15, carry out or delivery. To order, call 740-623-8483 or order online at pjz.com. And remember, Papa John's new location, 439 Cambridge Road.
This Eye on Weather forecast is brought to you by Sprint Print. Come visit Sprint Print for all your printing needs, including copies, business cards, all types of business printing, and advertising specialties. Sprint Print is still located at 520 Main Street, Coshocton, right behind Stewart Interiors. At Sprint Print, we hop to it.
Sunshine today, warm with highs in the lower 80s for tonight, clear, lows in the lower 50s, and for tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. And currently in Coshocton, it is 56 degrees. Our guests this morning are the folks from the Ohio History Connection. We've been speaking with Dr. Brad Lepper, archaeologist for Ohio History Connection. We also have with us Jen Altman. She's the director of historic sites and museums for the Ohio History Connection. And Jen, give us a little background of the Ohio History Connection and
sure.
What you are.
Sure, yeah. So our organization was founded in 1885, which often surprises people that it's been around for such a long time. And actually, its origin is connected to these earthworks. That I'll come back to that in a second. But we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, but we're really the state of Ohio's history partner. So in a lot of states, there's a state agency that takes care of this history work on behalf of the state. And in Ohio, it's us. So we're not technically a state agency, we're a 501c3, but we've been the state's partner for a really long time in this work. And it really started in 1885 around these earthworks that we're talking about and the objects that were being excavated from them. And what was happening was that organizations outside of Ohio were coming because people all over the world knew about the earthworks. They were coming and doing research and taking the objects. Some are in the British Museum. The Peabody Museum at Harvard did work at many of these sites. And people here in Ohio sort of felt like, well, gosh, you know, we ought to be doing this work and keeping these things here. And so that's really part of the founding of our organization so long ago. And Fort Ancient, which is one of the sites we've talked about briefly and part of this nomination, was really this first state park. And it was an effort to preserve that really significant history. So I think that's really a great part of the story for us as an organization is that for a very long time, people in the state of Ohio have wanted to preserve these places, and it's really a part of who we are and how we got started.
How many employees, how many people are part of Ohio History Connection?
Yeah, that's so it's a complicated question in that we've got a couple hundred employees, but we also have a site system all across the state that's 58 historic sites and museums, and many of those sites are run by local management partners. So they're not technically Ohio History Connection employees. They're local organizations that really care about local history, and they do that work every day in partnership with us to share it with their community and, you know, the state and beyond.
Is there any overlap, any collaboration, any association with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and the state park system?
So we collaborate sometimes. The sites in our system, the 58 sites, many of them are actually state of Ohio property. A few of them are Ohio History Connection property, but we treat them all the same. They are of public importance for everyone. And occasionally we have projects with Ohio Department of Natural Resources and other agencies. Right now there's a project happening near Xenia that's in collaboration with ODNR. So, yeah, we have some really great relationships working across the state to share history. As another example, Glacial Grooves, which is up on Kelly's Island mm-hmm. in Lake Erie. That's a site that where ODNR is actually our managing partner for that site, and they're making a really huge investment in that site this year. So later this year, by this fall, that site will have completely new infrastructure, and it'll be really a great place to visit. It'll be much more handicap accessible. And so that's a really great partnership with ODNR up at Glacial Grooves, bringing a great change to that site.
And how many, I think you already mentioned this, but about how many sites and museums are under the Ohio History Connection umbrella?
Yeah, we have 58 historic sites. Not all of those have museums. There is the big, what people think of as the State Museum in Columbus, the Ohio History Center. Some sites, like Fort Ancient Earthworks, they have a pretty sizable museum there. Some of our sites are really sort of roadside stops. And so the best thing, you know, if people want to visit and kind of put together a trip, is to go to our website at ohiohistory.org, and there's a visit tab, and you can go through and see where the sites are and get a sense of how long you should plan for a visit. You know, some sites are a 30-minute visit, and some sites are really a full-day visit. You think of a place like Zor Village, which isn't too far from here. You can definitely spend a whole day at Zor.
And one of the, I've got in my notes here, the reason is that it was just a couple of years ago, I was just taking a tour of the state of Ohio, and realizing that the Ohio History Connection has been around a long time, that's where mm-hmm. it got my attention, and that was the Buffington Island Park. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of Civil War scholars and people, but a lot of folks around here maybe not realize that there was one significant Civil War battle here in the state of Ohio.
That's right, at Buffington Island. And so some people are aware of Morgan's Raid. Sometimes it gets called John Hunt Morgan and Confederate cavalry. They came through the southern part of the state and ended up, one of the things that happened during that raid was this battle at Buffington Island. So we have a very small site there. There's just a few acres that commemorates, you know, it's just a piece of that battlefield. But this is where local partnerships are really great. There's a local organization that works on battlefield preservation there, and they're working to acquire more of that battlefield site. So we work together to try to preserve that, because it is really significant that's Ohio's Civil War battlefield. And, you know, I think that was sort of a turning point in some ways. So there are lots of sites like that people go to, and it's not always apparent. When you stand there on our few acres at Buffington Island, you really have to, you know, go to the website and read about it before you go. Because a lot of times these sites are mostly an open field, but what's really important to us is that they're preserved, right? Because that's what allows us to keep telling the story. So we try to provide lots of information on our website so people can have a good sense before they go of what the importance of what they're about to see.
Well, and Buffington Island, again, a small site, relatively speaking, but a beautiful wooded spot there on the Ohio River, and there's a mound there as well, right?
Yeah, there's one right nearby. It's not on our 6 acres, I don't think, but it's right nearby. And that's the thing with that part of Ohio is mounds are everywhere. And, you know, there was a map made in, Brad will remember, I think it was 1914, the Mills map, where there was sort of a write-in campaign about, you know, tell us about the mounds and earthworks in your communities across the state. And there were over 10,000 mounds, right? And something like 600 and some odd earthworks. So mounds being the sort of small, single, you know, usually burial mounds, and earthworks being these vast enclosures that Brad was talking about. But they are really everywhere. I looked at that map, and I think there was one county in Ohio where there weren't any sites documented up in Northwest Ohio. But all over the state, we get that question a lot, like, oh, you know that mound down mm-hmm. on, you know, such and such road. And I'm like, well, I don't know that one because there were over 10,000. But, yeah.
Okay. What about Ohio History Connection sites in and around Coshocton County? The John and Annie Glenn Museum, is that one of them?
Yep. John and Annie Glenn, New Concord. That's a great living history place. So it's like sort of like stepping back in time when you go there. Really portrays the Glenn's lives. They do some sort of first person interpretation, which means people are sometimes costumed and acting as if they're from the time period. And it's really like a step back in time to the 50s, and it's just a really fun place that people love to visit. So a lot of sites right now are just reopening for the season. May 1st was a big opening date. I believe that's when they reopened. We always tell people to check the website because sometimes things shift around. But John and Annie Glenn Museum is really a lot of fun. I encourage people to go. They do a great job there. We also recently had a big anniversary that we celebrated at Schoenbrunn, and so they're celebrating it all year long. Schoenbrunn, which was a Moravian mission to the Delaware Indians, they were established 250 years ago this month. And so there was an event a couple weeks ago, and there were Moravians who came from out of state, Delaware who came from out of state, and just really wanted to mark the importance of that occasion, of those two groups coming together to establish that site and live together peaceably. So that's a big one. Schoenbrunn's opening day is May 31st, I believe. Of course, check their website, but it's definitely the season when things are opening back up.
I remember when I was a kid, maybe third grade or so, we took a field trip to Schoenbrunn, and I didn't know what I was looking at the time. But yeah. Do you still have a lot of kids, a lot of field trips to Schoenbrunn and any of these sites?
Yes. May is very, very busy at the sites because it's field trip season. Mm-hmm. It often works that state testing is done, and so that's what happens in May. Schoenbrunn, they see a lot of kids there. The Denison Railroad Depot, they do a great job being our local managing partner at Schoenbrunn. And there is something new to see at Schoenbrunn, which is there are a number of sort of reconstructed cabins, and there was a new one added this year called the Shibosh Home. And so encourage people to go. I think they're finishing up just a couple of pieces of that, but hopefully for May 31st, everything will be all in place. And, you know, one of the things about Schoenbrunn is that with those reconstructed cabins, people often don't realize that that's only a part of what was there. So what we're showing is sort of a slice of life. There were actually sort of three streets in that town. It was much bigger than people have a sense, you know, when they go there today. So really encourage you to go into the museum. There's some new exhibits, really great interpretation of that history.
Another one that's not too far away from us, the National Road Museum, yep. A little more recent history. It had to close for a while, though, didn't it, because of COVID? A lot of sites have to do that?
Yeah, it was tough. COVID was tough because many of our sites, you know, our site managing partners, they do a great job, but there are a lot of folks who rely on volunteers to be open to the public. And so everyone's sort of coming back from that. So National Road, I believe that they had an opening date of May 1st, too, I think. But again, always check our website. And that's such an interesting place where they're really telling three stories, the great story of the National Road and what that has meant for America, the story of Zane Grey, the great Western author, and then ceramics and pottery, which is such a big deal in that part of Ohio with, you know, all of the people think about Zanesville pottery. And so they tell part of that story at National Road. We also have an East Liverpool Museum of Ceramics.
Mm-hmm.
So that industrial history of Ohio in all of its different forms is also part of our site system.
And when the Newark Earthworks becomes a World Heritage Site, mm-hmm. I'm sure that will be a crown jewel. But as it stands right now, are there any other museums or sites that you would consider the premium spots or the crown jewels in the system?
Well, I have to say they all are, right?
Well, you have to say that, yeah. But what are the ones that gets the most visitation or mm-hmm. has the largest museum or gets the most visitors?
Yeah, well, the museum in Columbus is really the largest museum. Some of our sites get a lot of visitation. We have Armstrong Air and Space Museum and mm-hmm. Wapakoneta, more recent history. Again, people love that. Kids, I frankly, myself, have been going to Armstrong Air and Space pretty much every year since I can remember. So good. I'm not going to say how many years that is, but yes. I also would point out Serpent Mound. We have a really exciting partnership there. So Serpent Mound in Peebles, Ohio, an American Indian earthwork. Brad has been in an interesting academic conversation, scholarly conversation, about how old Serpent Mound is and when it was built. We think it's about 1,000 years old or so. And as an American Indian earthwork, and we have a great partnership with the Shawnee and Eastern Shawnee tribes. And so last year we co-programmed a summer solstice event because Serpent Mound, the head of the serpent, aligns to the sunset on the summer solstice. And it's an important site for them. There's a snake or a serpent clan among the Shawnee. And we're going to do that again this year. So the weekend of June 18th, 19th, and then all the way through the actual solstice on the 21st, we'll have tribal partners there. We'll be providing programming throughout those 4 days. So I encourage people to check out ohiohistory.org to find that schedule of events, which we are working to finalize now and will be up very soon.
Are there any other projects or sites that are in place right now that Ohio History Connections is working towards either to designate or to be a part of Ohio History Connection? What's the organization working on right now?
Yeah, there's always something. Right now, one site we're working on is in Columbus, actually, the Poindexter Village site. And that is just two buildings that remain from one of the first public housing efforts in the country, and really significant in the African-American community's history in Columbus, but really in all of Columbus history. And so that's a site that isn't really open to the public yet. We're working to develop that museum, but very excited to tell that story. Many stories connected to Poindexter Village, and many people who I think are sort of Columbus celebrities, like Angela Pace, lived at Poindexter Village. And so, yeah, that's a great partnership with the city of Columbus, and we're really looking forward to bringing that site to the public.
What are some fun historical tidbits about Ohio that you love to share with people that people ooh. Don't know, or that they go ooh and ah when they find out? Is there anything you think of off the top of your head?
Ooh, I'm an Ohioan by birth. There's so many things. I have to confess, I'm a landscape archaeologist by training, so one of the things I love about Ohio is actually its glacial history. Mm-hmm. I love that when you drive across the state, you can see, the parts that were heavily glaciated and the parts like we are right now in Coshocton, that were sort of on the edge of that. And an interesting tie-in with that is that the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks, they mostly, not all of them, but these large ones really sit right at that interface between the flat, heavily glaciated part of Ohio and the less glaciated part of Ohio. So mm-hmm. when I drive out of Columbus towards Coshocton, I know, like, oh, I'm about to get to Newark because I see the hills mm-hmm. coming up on the horizon. And that's the kind of thing for me that, you know, I get really excited about having people see the places that they live every day in a new way. And to think about, oh, it looks like this because there were glaciers here,
yeah,
right, is really incredible to me.
And you know what you're looking at when you know that drive between Coshocton and Newark, and mm-hmm. that's sort of a little encapsulation of our glacial history right
yep.
there.
Which connects, of course, to the Glacial Groove site up on mm-hmm. Lake Erie, where you can actually see how the glaciers scoured that bedrock.
We need to take another break. We will be back around one more time with the folks from Ohio History Connection right after these words.
With the first big holiday just a few weeks away, we have a deal for you. Hi, I'm Craig Abner, the sales manager at the Jeff Drennan Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram dealership located here in beautiful Coshocton. Help us celebrate this Memorial Day all month long. Are you and your family thinking about a summer vacation, ball games, taking a road trip? Well, we're here to help. We have a great selection of third row vehicles to haul you and your team anywhere you're heading. Our lot is full of clean, dependable, safety-checked vehicles priced just right. Make Jeff Drennan's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram your first stop and see for yourself why so many people choose us for their vehicle needs. Chrysler Jeep Dodge of Coshocton.com.
For winning Ohio lottery numbers 24 hours a day, call the Be Dry Lottery line at 622-CALL. That's 622-2255. Let Be Dry transform your damp basement into useful living space.
You want to feel important. You want to be a part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things. You want to feel like you belong. We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it. We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers. We are normal people just like you. And together, we can make a difference. Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Ohio Army National Guard. Aired by the Ohio Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Are you starting to question your gambling?
Or the actions of someone you love?
It may be time to talk to someone who understands.
Call the Problem Gambling Helpline today and talk to a trained specialist.
There's no judgment and no commitment.
Plus, it's completely free and confidential.
We are here for you. You are not alone.
And remember,
we all have the power to change.
With the Problem Gambling Helpline of Ohio.
Make the call today.
Call the Problem Gambling Helpline of Ohio at 1-800-589-9966.
It's the little moments that have the biggest impact. Every time you mentor a child or donate your time or money, you empower their future. You can help make a difference and be a hero in the eyes of a child, one simple act of encouragement at a time. Positive childhoods lead to promising futures. Help prevent child abuse and neglect in your community. Learn more at octf.ohio.gov.
Are you dreaming of something greater? A college degree, job skills, a rewarding career?
The Ohio Army National Guard can help you get the education you need to land the career you've always wanted. The Ohio National Guard Scholarship Program could pay 100% of your college tuition. You're eligible for the scholarship as soon as you enlist. Learn more about the many benefits that come with serving in the Ohio Army National Guard. Visit NationalGuard.com today. Sponsored by the Ohio Army National Guard, aired by the Ohio Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Only Best Heating and Air can give you authentic Lennox quality and service for your home's heating and cooling needs. They're the people you know and trust right in our community. With regular annual maintenance from Best Heating and Air, you can keep your air perfect year-round and your home's heating and cooling system running at peak performance. Think Best Heating and Air to keep your system running perfectly season after season. Call 740-545-9400 today or visit online at www.bestheatingandac.com to schedule an appointment today. Dealer license number 30482.
Call the Jeff Drennan's Ford Sports Line at 623-9867. Hi, I'm Adam Peters. Join us for our Memorial Day sale with $2,500 minimum for your trade-in during the whole month of May, only at Jeff Drennan Ford.
Rio McCoy Barbecue has great news. They'll be open today, 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., and tomorrow, 11 a.m. to close. Rio McCoy Barbecue is located on County Road 621, across from Hans. Today's menu, pulled pork sandwiches, pork nachos, mac bowls, and mama's noodles. Tomorrow, their normal menu, plus chicken quarters and ribs. Rio McCoy Barbecue open today, 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., and tomorrow, 11 a.m., to sold out.
Join us for the second annual .5K race for United Way on Saturday, May 14th at 10:30 a.m. This year we are meeting outside of the United Way office where Main Street will be closed from 4th to 5th Streets. Early bird registration of $25 is being extended to Thursday, May 12th. Everyone registered will get a free lunch provided by the Main Street station. Remember that awards will be given out, so be sure to assemble the largest team possible, wear your wackiest costume, or break more rules than anyone. No sweating is allowed. Register at CoshoctonUnitedWay.org. We will see you Saturday, May 14th at 10:30 a.m.
This Island weather forecast is brought to you by H&H Auto Body. If you're involved in a collision, don't trust just anyone. Come see us at H&H Auto Body, Otsego Avenue. For 45 years, H&H Auto Body has been providing the very best in collision repair.
Sunshine today and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Clear tonight, lows in the lower 50s. And for tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. 72 degrees currently in Coshocton. 72 degrees. Another beautiful day ahead of us. We are back once again, this time around with Jen Altman, the Director of Historic Sites and Museums for the Ohio History Connection. And we mentioned some of the sites that are close to Coshocton, the Glenn Museum, National Road Museum, Schönbrunn, et cetera. Not too much farther up the road from Schönbrunn. We've got Zohr Village. You got a big event coming up there?
Yeah, so Zohr Village has a May Fest, and it's the Saturday, May 14th. From 10 to 5, and it's all the great things you might imagine. Beer and brats and bands is what I usually think the three B's with Mayfest. So it's just a fun event. Really invite people to come up. Zohr is such a beautiful place this time of year, and so want to make sure folks know about that one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on this time of year. So there's also, if people are headed towards Columbus, on May 21st, the Ohio Village is having its big season opening. So that is always a lot of fun there as well. And while folks are there, inside of the Ohio History Center, we have a new exhibit, and it's actually centered around World Heritage. So I encourage people, it's called the Indigenous Wonders of Our World, and they will get to understand more about these eight sites that are part of this World Heritage nomination, learn a little bit about each of them, get to experience a really great, I think, Brad, this is probably our favorite part, experience a really great sort of computer simulation of the octagon earthworks, and you can play with making the moon rise and set and see the alignments. So that's a lot of fun. And then also there's an area where you can choose to go and see some of the objects that Brad talked about. And they're presented in a new way, which is that we have put objects that are from sort of the same mound context together. So you're actually seeing things together that belong together. Really encourage people when they come to Ohio Village for the opening on the 21st, come into the center and see indigenous wonders of our world.
The Ohio History Center, is that what it's called?
Yes. Okay. Yep, in Columbus on 17th at the 17th Avenue.
Right there by the fairgrounds.
Yep, exactly.
So has that been a part of the Ohio History Connection since the beginning? Forever?
That building hasn't been since forever, and I usually defer to Brad about the early history and the buildings that we started in.
Brad?
Well, the building started at Ohio State University. Several of the buildings there, Orton Hall, Page Hall, and Sullivan Hall, all were former museum locations for the Ohio History Connection.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so did the Ohio History Connection used to have a different name?
It did.
Okay. Many different names.
Yeah, many different names.
Well, that might be what's leading to some of my confusion here.
Yeah.
How long has it been, approximately how long has it been the Ohio History Connection?
I think it was 2014.
Okay.
So before that, people would know us as the Ohio Historical Society.
Okay.
But for those of us who do research, into the deeper past, we find that, the Ohio Archaeological and Historical Society was a name along the way. So it's all the same organization, all the state's nonprofit history partner that's really been tasked with taking care of these most important history places in the state.
Well, what other events are coming up at sites or other activities or aspects of the Ohio History Connection would you like to share with us today?
We should invite people out to the Octagon Open House in July, and I'm going to have to say it's July 25th, the Octagon is, the site will be fully open to the public that day. And that means that we'll both be out there, Brad and I will be there, leading tours, talking to people. And so it's really one of the 4 days in the year when you can walk through and experience that whole site. So that day and having full access to that site is really important to us. And what's really fun is that people come from very far away for that event. It seems like there are a lot of people in England who love mounds and earthworks.
Mm-hmm.
Just encourage people to come out on the 25th to visit us at the Octagon Earthworks.
You mentioned your website a couple of times. What all will folks find there?
Lots of information. So ohiohistory.org, there are several tabs across the top. There's information about the site system. You can learn about each site. You can learn about upcoming events. And then there are some other parts of our website that are more sort of research-oriented or Ohio memory. There are historic photos, historic documents. I know Brad works with those parts of the website a fair bit. So there's just lots of content there. So whether you're just trying to find out, if I want to visit, what time is this museum open? Or whether you frankly want to get lost for hours and hours into historic photos and documents, you will find it all on ohiohistory.org.
It is a very, there's a lot there, a lot of things. And you can, in fact, spend a whole day or more on it. Jen, anything else you'd like to share with us about Ohio Heritage?
I would just really encourage people. We're all really passionate about local history, and with 58 sites in our system, one of the great benefits, we have a membership program, and when people join Ohio History Connection, they get access to all 58 sites. So you get a card, you go to any of those sites, you're not going to pay admission fees, and I frankly think it's one of the best deals in the state because that's a lot of sites that you can have access to. And Ohio just has such a broad history. Really encourage people to consider being members. And, we are just so excited about the possibilities of World Heritage. We're really hopeful that next summer we might be in front of the World Heritage Committee, having them, vote on this nomination. So there's just a lot of enthusiasm for these sites and for Ohio history right now.
Miscellaneous question. You mentioned in passing that you specialize or have a background in architectural or archaeology. Is that what you said?
Landscape.
Landscape. So what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, that means I think about how people's lives, how the landscape has shaped people's lives. And that's why when you ask me the question about a piece of Ohio history that really resonates with me, I think you can't go anywhere in Ohio without thinking about how our lives connect with the land that's around us. So I'm always encouraging people to get out and see that land with those historical eyes. So the way that we sort of live in this space today is connected to the geology. It's connected to, if you live in the flat part of Ohio, like my relatives are from Northwest Ohio, that's very different than being from Southeast Ohio. So that's you know, that's just a little bit of it. I did a lot of archaeology work in Virginia when I was there for a little while, but in Ohio, that's what I really love about it.
Are there any sites or things that Ohio History Connection that are dedicated to the Lenape or the Delaware, or the native people that lived here in Coshocton County?
Mm-hmm. Well, so Schoenbrunn, of course, was that Delaware Moravian mission. So, yeah, many of our sites, Schoenbrunn is one of the clearest where we were working with the Delaware tribes, the Lenape tribes today. But for any of our work across the state, we consult with American Indian tribal nations, so federally recognized tribes, because I think, as you know, many people are aware, those tribes were forcibly removed from the state of Ohio. But they're very much alive and vibrant today, and they're excited, many of them, to reconnect with Ohio and to be partners in telling their history. There's probably, we could argue about the exact number, but something around 14,000 years of American Indian history in Ohio. You think of a place like Flint Ridge, right in Licking County, which is pretty nearby, that encompasses so much of that. And so we're really excited about those partnerships today and working with the living tribal nations and being partners in telling their stories.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, certainly very informative, and learned a lot this morning. And, Brad, at this point in time on May the 11th, 2022, what is the current status of the pending designation of World Heritage Site for the Newark Earthworks? What is going on right now?
Well, our nomination is on the desks of people in Paris who are reading it and evaluating it, and they're getting ready to pick the person that they're going to send here to evaluate our sites.
Anything else either of you'd like to share with us before we wrap up this morning?
We just really appreciate the opportunity to be here and encourage people to get out there and visit the sites. The weather's getting nice. And it's the time to do it. There's so much going on. So, again, just go to ohiohistory.org, and you can check out your nearest site and what events are coming up.
We'll do this again sometime. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, that is Dr. Brad Lopper, the senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at Ohio History Connection. And Jen Altman, she is the director of historic sites and museums for the Ohio History Connection. And you can go to their website and learn a lot more about all of the things that we talked about this morning. It is 10:56. I'll be back around one more time right after this.
Right person to join our team. If you want to help local businesses with their marketing needs, we want to talk with you. If you want to learn more, find out by calling me, Chris Wallace, at 622-1560 or by emailing your information to WTNS993@yahoo.com. Again, that's WTNS993@yahoo.com. WTNS AM/FM is an equal opportunity employer.
Are you wanting to be part of something greater? This is Staff Sergeant Hogan, your local Ohio Army National Guard recruiter. With the Ohio Army National Guard, you can be part of something greater, helping your local community, state, and country. We offer great benefits, including debt-free college, paid skill training, and more. Contact me today for more information at 740-602-0577. Live here, work here, and serve here. Sponsored by the Ohio Army National Guard, aired by the Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Dad! Come on! Over here! Look at this, Dad! Over! Whoa!
The moment my son saw a redwood tree.
It's huge!
Is the moment I knew that for him.
You can't even see the top of that thing!
Even the sky has no limit.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, biking, fishing, or camping. Or do your own thing when you get there with family and friends. Your moment is out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive.
And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmer is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
The West Lafayette Branch Library is inviting youth from grades 3 to 12 to tween and teen time at the branch on the third Thursday of each month. Tweens and teens can meet up with friends, play games, make art, and enjoy snacks and pop. The next event will be held on Thursday, May 19th from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Please register at coshoctonlibrary.org or by calling 740-545-6672.
The Coshocton Public Library System. Explore a world of possibilities.
This island weather forecast is brought to you by H&H Auto Body. If you're involved in a collision, don't trust just anyone. Come see us at H&H Auto Body, Otsego Avenue. For 45 years, H&H Auto Body has been providing the very best in collision repair.
Sunshine today, warm with highs in the lower 80s. Clear tonight, lows in the lower 50s. And for tomorrow, sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Currently, it is 73 degrees in Coshocton. And we'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us this morning. They are folks from the Louisville Slugger Museum and Factory in Louisville, Kentucky, and the folks from the Ohio History Connection as well, Dr. Brad Lepper and Jen Altman. Weather forecast says sunshine today and warm with highs in the lower 80s. Clear tonight, lows in the lower 50s, and tomorrow sunny and warm with highs in the lower 80s. 73 degrees currently in Coshocton. This is WTNS-FM, Coshocton, Ohio. It's 11 o'clock.
Listen to the WTNS communication lines Monday through Friday from 9 until 11 a.m. on WTNS-FM 99.3 or online at mywtnsradio.com.